Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, March 27th. I'm Ray Graff. Today we welcome back Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson to talk about astronomy. If you have a question about the heavens, this team is ready to answer them. 800-348-2551 is the number. 1-800-348-2551. You can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. voxpop@wamc.org. Or 800-348-2551. Bob Berman, Valerie Rapson, and your astronomy questions coming up right after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. We have two astronomers in the studio today to answer your questions about space, the final frontier. One of the best-known, most widely read astronomers in the world, Bob Berman, has been AWOL a while, but he's back. He has been traveling the globe, presumably just this planet, but I don't know. Also, Dr. Valerie Rapson is here, assistant professor of physics and astronomy at SUNY Oneonta. She earned her PhD in astrophysical science and technology at the Rochester Institute of Technology. If you have a question about space or time, or the fabric of the very fabric of our existence, give us a call. 800-348-2551 is the number. 1-800-348-2551. Or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Bob Berman, where have you been?
Oh, it's been fun. So first vacations around South America to the Falklands. Then to India. My wife's never been there. And so we chose three Indian states, Kerala, and up north to Himachal Pradesh, and visited the Dalai Lama's home.
Was he there?
No, he wasn't there.
Okay.
And the third was to Rajasthan for a deserty type of milieu. So that was nice. Then as soon as I got back a week later to Alaska, where you and Valerie both told me before I left, you said, well, with all this solar activity, I'll bet Alaska's going to be amazing. And it was. And I'm happy that our group that went there, this was in the 30 years that we've been going every single March.
Yeah.
And I know what you're thinking. Winter in Alaska, are you sure that would attract anyone? And yes. And I'm happy to say this group, this was the fourth best aurora I've ever seen. It was just wonderful.
Okay, so it was the fourth best. The picture was stunning. How do you rate these things?
Okay, well, this is what we look for. Here, when we get a good aurora, like we did in 1989, generally, with few exceptions, once in a while we get an exception, it's a glow. And that's nice. And sometimes you see colors like a reddish, and that's nice. But in when you really get a great one in Alaska or in, let's say, Scandinavia, which are rare only because it's cloudy all the time there, you can get motion, distinct color, extra colors, and detail in the aurora. In other words, not just a blob of color, but it can look like a curtain, like drapery.
I've seen that around here. I don't have to go to Alaska for
and
that.
Motion so that it looks like it's rustling curtains.
Yeah, I've seen that.
And you actually see that with the eye, and people who were using just cell phone cameras were getting great shots without even long exposures.
So interesting.
That's what does
cool.
It.
Valerie Rapson, how are things going at SUNY Oneonta?
Oh, they're going really good, really good. We're more than halfway done with the semester, so
how are
things
the kids?
Are moving on. Oh, they're great.
Are they precocious?
No, they're good.
No, precocious is good. Are they smart and, they could be a little troublesome and bratty, I suppose,
at times,
and precocious.
At times, but, they're all doing really well. My astronomy students are, fascinating. We just finished the lessons on the planets, and they were so captivated learning about, the water on Mars and just all the stuff that, if you're not into astronomy, you don't really know about, but...
Let me ask you a question. You're a professor, and I'm sure you're tough on your kids. You crack the old whip. But, it's March Madness. And with all the devices,
I know.
How do you keep their attention?
We try. We have this rule in my intro astronomy class now where if I'm lecturing, if I'm talking and sharing information, you got to listen. But we often do activities as part of class to, practice what we learned. And I told them that they can have their devices on with the game off to the side as long as they're still completing the activity.
Yes.
So for the next couple of weeks or so, or however long it lasts, because I'm not a huge basketball fan,
it'll
so I don't
while.
Even know. But
all of well, we have what Sweet 16 coming up.
That I heard, right?
Yeah. So you got a couple weeks.
The big games tonight, so that's fine. As long as they're still learning some astronomy, I'm happy.
All right. A couple of articles. We've kind of been going back and forth the last couple of weeks. And this one, I don't have the date on this, but I think it was fairly recently. This is from CNN, Ashley Strickland. Oxygen detected in the most distant galaxy ever found. First paragraph says, astronomers have made the surprising discovery of oxygen and elements like heavy metals in the most distant known galaxy. That's 13.4 billion light years away, which means it's a relative handful of years after the Big Bang. Mm-hmm. So, Valerie, you and I have been talking about this, and Bob, I think you're up to speed as well. What is this? What's the significance of this?
Yeah, well, this is really cool. So you're seeing this young galaxy that has oxygen, which, you know, we consider a metal in astronomy. It's not really a metal, but, you know, it's one of these heavier elements. It's not hydrogen and helium. And the only way to get the elevated levels that we see in this galaxy is for there to have been multiple cycles of stars that were born and died, and all of the oxygen that was made inside of the stars was released into the galaxy. And originally we thought that, you know, galaxies would form a little bit slower. It would take some time for these stars to evolve. So maybe you'd go through like one cycle of star formation and death in this time frame. But we're seeing what looks like much faster evolution. So it makes us think that the galaxies form faster and maybe more stars have formed and created this oxygen-rich environment that we didn't expect.
That's amazing. Bob, Valerie just mentioned oxygen, technically a metal. We've seen trucks carrying liquid oxygen. If there was enough pressure and or if it was cold enough, could that in fact be a metal?
Not oxygen. Hydrogen acts like a metal under a pressure when it's under certain conditions, but not oxygen. And Valerie very correctly said that you don't get oxygen from the Big Bang. You need generations of stars. So this is one more nail in what may be the coffin of what was the presumed understanding of the time frame of the early universe. Because, oh, yes, we know the universe turned transparent 379,000 years after the Big Bang, or at least we think we know that. We know the first stars formed some millions of years later, the first galaxies formed, and all of this takes time. So to have the result of generations of stars, like our sun is a third generation star.
Yeah.
That's why we've got the stuff in our bodies that we do, the iron in the hemoglobin in our blood. It's because our sun and everything around it, including Earth, mm-hmm. is a third generation star, meaning that there were two other generations of stars that were born, went through their life cycle, either exploded or else expelled through a solar wind, a stellar wind, a material into space, and enriched their environment with things other than hydrogen and helium. This takes time. Mm-hmm. But here is one of the youngest galaxies ever that has this stuff. So either we're wrong about the whole time frame, and maybe we are, because let's face it, this whole stuff is mysterious. Big Bang, is that an explanation to say, oh, yeah, it popped out of nothing? You know, at one time when I went to school, if I said to my professor, this is how it happened, it popped out of nothing, they wouldn't have said, oh, very good, Mr. Berman, very good, we'll give you an A for that answer. No, they would have said, sit the hell down.
All right.
You have no idea what you're talking about. So it just shows once again we're in our infancy with things like that, which is one reason why I love looking at Copernicus through the telescope, because its 57-mile diameter is not going to change. 100 years from now, we're still going to know it's 57 miles in diameter, and it's nice to have some stuff that's not going to be revised.
Copernicus is 57 miles in diameter?
Yeah, yeah. Beautiful crater. Some say the best.
Oh, crater. I thought it was some kind of a star. I was going to say that'd be a very small
star. Or person,
star.
Right? You know, just floating up there in space.
A large, fat Copernicus walking around. And then the other one, and then we'll take a break, and then we'll go to the phones. 800-348-2551. Dr. Valerie Rapson is here. Bob Berman is here. It's Astronomy Today. The other one from Newsweek. This is about 10 days old now. Mysterious James Webb discovery could mean we live in a black hole.
Well, I hate the stuff that I've already written in previous books, like in the 80s and 90s when I was writing most of my 12 books. And if in one of the chapters I said, this whole universe could be a black hole, and this is how. Oh, it's actually quite simple to understand. If, no matter how fast you went, if you could achieve the speed of light and yet still never escape from our universe because it has enough mass to stop that, which is possible, that means we live inside a black hole. The universe is a black hole. And this just means that, yeah, it really might be true. And I would love it. They've never done it, not once, even though that book got a great review in the New York Times. No one has ever said, yes, according to Bob Berman back in 1985, it's proven that he was right.
We all know you're a visionary. But in this case,
frustrated is what I am.
James Webb Telescope has some images, Valerie, that show about two-thirds of 263 galaxies imaged, which isn't a very great deal, rotate in the opposite direction to our Milky Way galaxy. Mm-hmm. It should be even, right?
Yeah, roughly even. That's what we would expect as you get to larger numbers. And, you know, this theory is not really testing the speed of light idea, but more of looking at these galaxies that all appear to be rotating. About two-thirds of them are rotating in the opposite direction that we rotate. Like, if we just pick a reference frame and say we're going one way and compare the other galaxies, two-thirds are going the other way. And since there's only two choices, you would expect 50-50. But we see more of them that are rotating in one direction. And there's lots of possible examples for it, some more practical than others. But one of the ones that's kind of a stretch idea is that if we actually existed inside of a black hole, and black holes have properties that allow them to spin, there could be some bulk rotation of the universe that is causing more galaxies to spin one way than the other, which could be attributed to the black hole.
Interesting. Now, does that negate the need for dark energy? Dark matter?
No, not at all. I mean, this is like, you know, one little piece of evidence that could support this kind of extended theory, but then 18 million more questions are raised, right? If this is true, then how do we explain dark matter, dark energy, all the other observations that we see? So it's much more likely that it has something to do with galaxy dynamics and, you know, kind of like what we were talking about with this oxygen-enriched galaxy. You know, how these galaxies form, especially the far away ones, is still an open question. So maybe there's just something we're missing about the initial rotation of them.
I'm going with Berman on this. We're living in a black hole. He was 30 years ahead of his time. And when it's finally discovered and proven, it'll have to be named after, the universe will have to be named after Berman. What do you think? What do you think?
The universe of Berman.
Let's take a break. 800-348-2551. That's the number. We'll get to the calls in a minute. Astronomy with Valerie Rapson and Bob Berman. We'll be back. Appropriate. Sonny Rollins, Sonny Sphere here on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551 is the number. It's Astronomy with Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson. We go to the phones in a moment. Just some breaking news here. Saturn has more moons.
Yes.
What are they up to now?
274.
Wow.
I know we've talked about this running joke in my department before, where every time I teach an astronomy class, I have to update the slide with the number of moons in the solar system. Some planet or another just keeps getting another couple. And this time it was like 120 all discovered.
You know,
at once.
Bob remembers when there was only five.
Yeah, I was not born yet when
that
was
five
true.
For Uranus, nine for Saturn. Then there was the 10th Janus. That was a big deal.
You run out of fingers and toes.
Yeah.
Now it's out of hand.
Bob also remembers when there were only three planets. So that's 800-348-2551. Let's go to David in New Paltz. David, you're on.
Yes. My question is, they launched a telescope to map the universe. My question is, how can you map a universe that is, everything is in motion, including the telescope and the Earth and solar system, and not to mention the fact that the light coming from those stars are probably thousands of years old and might not even be there anymore?
Yeah.
That's my question.
It's definitely not an easy thing to do. I mean, many of the telescopes in space are either orbiting the Earth, or with James Webb, it's kind of following the Earth around the sun. And you basically have to use gyroscopes on board to hold the telescope steady and point them in one direction of the sky so that you can basically take pictures of where everything is right now. And the cool thing we can do with all of this historical data we have now is compare, you know, what it looked like in the 1980s and 90s to today and see how everything is moving. Because you're right, things are moving all over in outer space.
All right, David.
Well, it's confusing, you know.
Yes, it is.
How do you know it's still there, you know?
I love it when people say this. Very often in astronomy sessions at the observatory, people will say, well, aren't a lot of these stars not even there? And I love it when people say that, even though it's wrong, because it means they correctly, just like the caller, correctly perceives that the speed of light is finite, not infinite, and that therefore the image takes some time to reach us, and maybe the star stopped existing in that time. But if you actually do the math, stars typically live for billions of years, and the distance, believe it or not, the distance to the stars in the night sky, the naked eye stars, the farthest of them are only a few thousand light years away, and the average is a few hundred light years away. So if you do the math, what are the chances that even one of the stars that you see in the night sky are no longer there? I once worked it out, and it works out for an article in Discover. It works out to be about 200 to 1, the odds against even one of the visible stars no longer being there. So it's true what the caller says.
200 to 1 are fairly low odds.
Yeah, so
in the
possible
grand scheme of things.
Yeah.
Just not likely.
David, thanks a lot. 800-348-2551 is our number. It's Astronomy with Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson. Chris writes in, if I traveled at a rate faster than the speed of light for 1 year, would I end up back in 2024 and not buy the stock that tanked in January? And then I got this one, she said, don't read it on the air, but I like it. This is from Sherry. I'm not listening to you guys much lately. Not good for my mental health. Roundtable panel, if I can stand it, and Vox Pop, because it's good for my mental health. Mm. And you know what, Sherry? It's okay to be a little stressed out. And thank you for sticking with us. We're with you in good times and bad times. 800-348-2551. Jim is in North Adams. Jim, go ahead.
Hello, yes, I've got you on speaker. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, the fidelity is not quite sterling, but we can deal.
I will hang on. I'll take you off speaker.
Okay. No, you're nothing. He hung up on himself. Jim, are you in a black hole? Hello? Okay, I think we made a major mistake because he didn't sound that bad. And I think what happened was he muted it. And he's shouting right now.
Oh, no.
Hey, Jim, did you mute the phone, buddy? Okay. You know what? Let's put Jim on hold, and we'll go to the next one. 800-348-2551. Stand by, Jim, in North Adams. We're gonna get to you. Richard is in Rensselaer. Richard, you're on.
Hi. It seems to me that for people living at the equator, the longest day, that is daylight of the year, would be on the equinoxes. Is that right?
No, because it never varies. At the equator, the minutes of daylight and night are always the same throughout the year.
Okay, but at the tropical Cancer, the longest day is definitely the summer.
Yeah, at the tropics of Cancer and Capricorn, what they do is they define the limits of when you can ever have that that cutoff. So if you're closer to the equator than the Tropic of Cancer, then you're just not going to get the effects that we do. As you know, if you continue getting north, you can even get to no daylight at all.
The days are always the same length.
Yeah, it actually defines the tropics. South of the Tropic of Cancer and north of the Tropic of Capricorn, that is Earth's tropics. That's in case you ever wondered whether it's just a term that means there's lots of palm trees and someone's going to hand you a pina colada once in a while. That's not it. It's just specifically those zones.
Yep. And all right. It all really just has to do with the angle of the Earth, right? I mean, that's why we have these effects. And at the equator, you know, you're basically getting almost direct sunlight most of the time. So your days kind of have equal length there.
All right, Richard, thanks a lot for that one. 800-348-2551. Bob, when you were down in the Falkland Islands, do you see any southern lights?
No, and they're possible there, and people do once in a while see them from down there. But we did see lots of wonderful, juicy penguins.
Ah, what do you mean, wonderful, juicy penguins? What the heck does that mean?
Never mind that adjective, juicy. That probably didn't. No, they were just so
disturbing.
Cute.
Is what
cute,
it is.
Cute. I meant to say cute.
Okay. All right. I won't have you on Pets and Vets. All right. Let's just agree on that. Jim in North Adams, you get everything straightened out there, buddy.
Yes, I'm on a landline now, so are you hearing me okay?
You got it. Go ahead.
Great. Question is about the aurora. Been puzzling me for about 33 years. Back then, we lived on a side of a mountain about 12 miles from the Canadian border in Vermont. Nearest town was Fairfield. Absolutely zero light pollution, which was fabulous. We were completely off the grid. Lit with kerosene, heated with wood, outhouse and all that. One night I got up and I went to go to the outhouse, and it was very, very still. It had to be mid-January, and when my dad was in the service, we used to go skiing in Norway, and I saw the wonderful auroras, but never seen one like this. This was the entire sky. I was sober. I hadn't. But it was like an acid trip. But I hadn't. My system was completely clean. This was the entire 360 degrees, greens, golds, blues, and just vibrating and pulsing. And I must have stood there for 15, 20 minutes. What was I witnessing? I'd never seen I didn't even know an aurora could take up an entire sky.
Where were you?
Where?
Yeah, where were you?
About 12 miles from the Canadian border in northern Vermont.
Right, gotcha. Okay.
Yeah, we get them like that once in a long time. 1989 was one such year, but I've seen a few times here, and I've lived here in upstate New York for 54 years now, and I'd say on three occasions saw what you've described. So they're kind of rare, but a whole sky, rapid flickering, we get them. Same process. You ask what causes them. Same process. Either we used to think that solar flares and coronal mass ejections, CMEs, which can throw 10 billion tons of solar material into the sky. And then if that storm happens to be in the right spot of the sun, I'll tell you where you want it. Not in the middle of the sun, but 3 days of sun rotation to the right of that as you're facing the sun. And then the magnetic field of the sun will make the material follow a curved path called the Parker spiral right to us. Mm. The Parker spiral, yes. So now we find that there's a new thing, and that is there are coronal holes, that is openings in the sun's outer regions on the photosphere that let material in. We've also found out since the time that you saw that aurora that the underlying force is something we never suspected, that two-thirds of the way from the sun's center, which is where its core is, which actually generates all the heat and light, et cetera, two-thirds of the way out, the sun spins like a solid ball.
Mm.
But at that point, from that point outward, the sun spins erratically, where the equator takes about 30 days to make a rotation, and the poles it's just the other way around, 25. So there's a differential rotation. Well, we call it the tachocline. We never knew that existed. And thanks to a new type of solar research called helioseismology, where we see the sun pulsing like a giant subwoofer, and that lets us know what's under the surface.
Yeah, okay.
So we found that there's this layer that we never knew existed, and that's responsible for the storms the CMEs, the flares, it all is generated in that interface between the solidly spinning sun and the chaotically spinning sun. That's about two-thirds of the way out from the center. So, so not only is there the activity that you're talking about, but also we have a lot more knowledge as to what underlies
I'm going to have to go online and listen to that again because that was a lot to take in. But thank you. Thank you so much. And I feel blessed to having had witnessed it.
All right. Well, Jim, thanks a lot. Valerie.
We just saw another one of these coronal holes open up. I saw an article recently where more in the southern portion of the sun right now, these basically the sun's atmosphere, the corona, is more open, allowing more solar wind to come through. So there's a chance that we might see some more elevated levels of solar activity and auroras in the next couple of days as the sun continues to spin around. So keep an eye out for anything good.
Didn't we send a spaceship into the corona?
The Parker Solar Probe, yep.
Did it get there yet?
Yeah, so it's basically been doing orbits around the sun, and the goal was not to, like, shoot it at the sun and have it pass through and burn up. We want to try and orbit and get closer and closer without destroying the spacecraft. So it got as close as about 4 million miles, which sounds
very close.
Well, yeah, I was going to say it sounds far away, but in reality, remembering that we are 93 million miles from the sun, that's ridiculously close.
Yeah.
The temperatures are really high, and it's really kind of opened our eyes to many of the things Bob was mentioning about how the sun produces the solar wind and how it travels and ultimately reaches the Earth.
And a reminder, Bob's book, The Sun's Heartbeat, is a really ripping read. So, you know, you could check that out if you want to learn more about the sun. 800-348-2551 is our number. You can email voxpop@wamc.org if you wish. Let's go to Christy in Kinderhook. Christy.
Hi. I ask for your indulgence on this next question because it started when I was 12, and I'm just curious.
Okay.
So, during a science lesson in the evening, the stars were very bright, and the teacher said they're at different distances. And my immediate question is, and maybe you can help with this, if we were able to see far enough into the universe, would there be enough stars, if we mashed them all together in distance, to almost make it look like daylight out? And how would you even test for this?
Yeah. So initially, you might think that because of the, you know, there's a lot of stars in all directions. But when we look through the edge of our Milky Way galaxy, there are a lot of stars there. And it's possible that if you collected all the light from the stars and the gas and the dust, you'd have a really bright band, much brighter than what we actually see with our eyes. But if we look above and below the plane of the Milky Way galaxy, what we're really looking at is empty space, the space between the galaxies, which literally has essentially nothing, you know, very little amounts of gas and dust, but generally no stars or other bright objects. So you would likely see a much brighter band representing our galaxy, but in between, which is kind of, you know, 90% of the sky for us, you really would see essentially darkness, except for the little bits of galaxies that are scattered about.
Bob.
Now, I'd like to add that there is something called Olber's paradox that drove astronomers absolutely bat. I'm going to leave the last half of that. Olber's paradox. Olber, I forgot his first name, but he was the first person to point out this paradox, that if the universe is really as vast as they were starting to find out that it was in the 18th century, then every line of sight should come across a star. Now, it's true some of them are farther away, but that would be compensated for by the fact that there'd be more of them. Because when you're dealing with, if you're in the center of a sphere, the volume of a sphere is changes with the cube of distance. It's pi r cubed, whereas the number of stars you're talking about go by the square. So there should be more and more stars that would make up for their increased distance and increase faintness at distance. His bottom line is that if the universe is really vast, the whole sky should be as bright as daylight,
right,
which is what
what Christy was talking about.
Exactly what Christy was talking about, that the sky should be as bright as sunlight. But it isn't.
Oh.
And this drove astronomers crazy. What is the solution? And we've only in our lifetime, in my lifetime anyway, since I'm the oldest in the room, have we found the solution to Olber's paradox, which shows how many centuries it lingered and how long it took to find the answer. And the answer is twofold. One, in other words, why is the night sky dark? And one answer is that the universe is young. If we were infinitely old, there would have been more time for stars and galaxies to form, and there would have been more of them. The universe is too young. Also, in terms of it expanding, it's also too young to have sent that much light our way. And
So that's Olber's paradox.
Olber's paradox, okay. Yes.
Christy, does that make any sense, or are you just as confused as I am?
I have some tears in my eyes because at 12 years old, I had no idea about this paradox, and I knew I should have got into astrophysics. You know, I missed my calling, but I'm so glad to know that I had a good question at such a young age, and I'm so excited about. I have the NASA channel, and I just love everything about space. So thank you so much.
That's awesome. And you know what? I have tears in my eyes as well because, it's just the end of my career. 800-348-2551. We'll talk about Uber's paradox coming up. The shorter the drive you request, the longer it takes to get a driver. That's Uber's paradox. 800-348-2551. We'll be back. Another appropriate tune, Stella by Starlight. There's J.J. Johnson on Vox Pop, 800-348-2551. Most of the music I pick for this show is picked well in advance and completely separate from the topics. Mm. It's when it randomly works out like that twice today, it's pretty cool. All right, Bob, you have 1 minute to tell us about part two of Uber's paradox. Uber paradox.
Yeah, Christy's question, why is the night sky dark and not light? First half was that the universe is young and not infinitely old. But the second part of it is that we're expanding, which we only found out a century ago. And the expanding universe means that the light is redshifted, which is dimming the light. And the farther you look, the more it's redshifted and the more things are dimming. So just when you should be getting more and more stars and making things brighter, you're getting dimmer and dimmer stars and making things dimmer. So that's the second reason that Olber's paradox has a solution.
Mm-hmm. That's exciting. You want to add to that, Val?
No, Bob said it really great. And it's kind of neat how you can just walk outside and observe things like this, you know, see the darkness of space and think, you know, how much cool science there really is behind that simple observation.
You know, it's great. Like last night was a clear night, and it's just wonderful just to go out and look at the stars. I know you two are not the biggest satellite fans, but we love watching the satellites as well. It's a lot of fun. Let's go to Jeremy in Del Mar. Jeremy, go ahead.
Hey, Ray. Love the show.
Thanks. Appreciate it.
Great discussion. Was interested in the solar seismology and the subwoofer effects that are currently being studied, and was wondering, has there been any research done relating those effects to the development or modification of life on Earth? That's part A. And then part B, and would that make sense to begin to study those things for looking for life elsewhere in the universe?
Mm. They've definitely been, you know, observing the sun, not through the helioseismology and all of this type of complicated science for very long, but looking at like the convection currents in the sun and just kind of using that motion and how the sun moves and appears on the surface can really tell us a lot about what's happening on the inside. And the best we can do from the idea of, you know, how does it affect life and how it has historically affected life is to look at sunspot records, because that's the best that we have. And there doesn't really appear to be, you know, too much of a correlation between anything major that has happened. But we only have, you know, reliable sunspot records for the last couple hundred years or so. So there hasn't been anything major that has happened to the sun where, you know, a flare goes off and wipes out a whole something on Earth. That has not happened yet. But they are definitely, you know, keeping an eye on the sun and trying to understand how it affects our atmosphere, our climate, because the sun does change as the years go by.
Jeremy, thanks for the call. Bob, the the Maunder minimum was what, 1690?
1645 to 1715.
So they were counting them then. They were counting sunspots then. How did they do it without going blind?
Well, at that time they used colored glass eyepieces.
And they did go blind occasionally.
Did they?
There is some evidence that people may have stared at the sun too long. But they also had simple pinhole projections. If the sunlight shines just right through a crack in the wall, you can get a nice projection.
Can you see sunspots that way?
Yeah, that's what we did with the disco ball during the eclipse. We used the little mirrors on a disco ball to act like pinhead mirrors. And just, a couple meters away, you can get a pretty good sized image of the sun. And if the sunspots are large enough, you can see the spots.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Did they have disco balls in 1645?
No, but, any kind of, small either reflecting device or just a small pinhole, a crack in the side of a wall will work as long as the angle of the sun is just right.
Amazing. Go ahead, Bob.
The final thing that the caller said was talking about finding life elsewhere in the universe. Mm. And so at least from time to time, I'd like to bring this back a full 100 years again to the quantum theory guys who ended up concluding that consciousness, at least, is a fundamental property of the universe. And in recent years, if you look at the Nobel Prize in Physics in 2022, in recent years, I think that science is slowly moving in that direction of considering consciousness, which I, after all, is intelligence or a form of life, mm-hmm. even though it's little understood.
How do you quantify consciousness in a scientific way?
That's a believe it or not, a good question because
it's believe
murky,
it or not.
And to a lot of scientists, it's still a kind of woo-woo kind of Hindu, Buddhist, Eastern thing. So it's not approved in every science department in every college. But let's just say experience, conscious experience, just a parade of experiences of any kind, let's say, might define consciousness. And if that's true, that the basis of the universe is not just electrons or energy or electromagnetism or whatever else we've thought of it as being fundamental, but is consciousness is fundamental to the universe. Remember, Heisenberg and other pretty smart people insisted on this, at least by the end of their lives. Then when we're talking about the search for life, remember, we're talking about something that's not distant and far away and a maybe, but may become more and more a certainty and a part and parcel of something that's everywhere.
I got to say, I've missed this. You've been off for a couple months. We haven't talked about the consciousness of the universe, but now he's back. by the way, and I'm going to get this all wrong, but Lucas Willard, who hosts The Best of Our Knowledge, he and I were just chatting. He just got done with an interview with a quantum physicist. And look, Lucas is a radio guy. I'm a radio guy. So this is third hand and probably completely wrong, but the upshot of what they were talking about, and just part of it anyway, was that there could be these things called white holes. Mm-hmm. Have we heard about these things?
Yeah.
Tell me about a white hole.
We haven't seen any. That's the key. When we finally observe one, then we'll know. But the idea is that, if you have a black hole that pulls things in, you can have a white hole that spits things out.
So is that the Big Bang? The Big Bang?
That'd be speculative.
Yeah.
But the idea is maybe super. This has been said. Neither Valerie nor I believe it. And Valerie can correct me if I'm imposing a belief on her that she doesn't embrace. That supernovae and other places that we see brilliant light could be the light escaping from after having fallen into black holes elsewhere in the universe or at other times in the universe, since space and time are both malleable.
Okay, I withdraw that. So let's just move on. Rob says, help in time travel. Oh, boy. Has either guest ever been asked by a movie production company or comic book writer to advise on space travel, time travel, and or the such to bring some reality to the storyline?
I have not, but if there are any, movie TV companies listening, I would be happy to chat about astronomy for their shows anytime.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Ditto for Bob, it looks like.
Yeah, I have.
You
and
have.
I've forgotten the name of the group, publication company, guy in charge, because we're talking about 15, 20 years ago. But yes.
Okay.
But there are things that people want for free. Like, I was invited to speak at Princeton recently, and when we came down to what the remuneration would be, the answer was, oh, no, it's just an honor. Everyone considers it an honor. We have we don't pay anybody.
Right.
It's an honor.
It's like being on this show. It's quite an honor, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes. So I said, so let me just sum this up. So I'm supposed to travel 5 hours in each direction, pay for my own hotel and all expenses, and give a talk, prepare it, and deliver it because it's an honor. Is that what you're saying? And essentially, after a moment's pause, he said, well, yes.
All right. Why don't you take a chill pill? We'll take a call here. Let's go to Jim and Adams. Jim, you're on.
Yay, Ray.
How you doing, buddy?
Yes, yay, Bob, and I forgot the young lady's name.
Valerie.
Valerie, I'm sorry. Yes, I came into the program late, about 2:30. I don't know if you folks have discussed any of the upcoming partial lunar and solar eclipses or not yet.
Valerie mentioned it before the show, and we haven't gotten into it yet.
Yeah,
so
we can do it now.
Have at it,
okay,
people.
I'll keep listening.
No, hang in there, Jim. Go
Perfect.
Ahead.
Yeah. So a couple weeks ago, we had a lunar eclipse, total lunar eclipse. I got up at 3 a.m. to take a peek at it, and then I went back to bed. But the one coming up is this Saturday morning. There is a partial solar eclipse that, for us on the east coast of the United States, is not going to be that great because it starts at like 4:30, 5 o'clock in the morning, and the sun is not up for us yet. The sun doesn't rise until 6:30. So if you want to see anything, you have to have like a pristine view of the eastern horizon. So unless you're on, you know, the actual coast, you might not really get to see much. And even at that point for us, it's only going to be at about 20% of the sun covered, and then it's going to, you know, fade out. So it's not nearly as exciting as the one that we had last year, but if you do happen to have a good view of the East Coast, or you happen to be over in Europe during the time, they're going to get a much better view for a longer period of time.
All right, Bob.
What
Valerie said, let me just add to what Valerie said, because it's absolutely correct what she said, but I would add that the one great thing, you know, I'm anti partial solar eclipses in general, but the one great thing about them is that if they occur at sunrise or sunset, as Ray has pointed out, this is the safe time to look at the sun. We've all looked at sunsets without any eye protection.
I didn't point that out, man.
All right, somebody did.
You did. You take the legal blame.
All right. You can actually, we've all looked at sunsets, of course, without eye protection, especially if you only spend a few seconds looking at the sun. So that's the one safe time where you don't need those filters. So if the sun is rising or setting, eclipsed, already partially eclipsed, the sight of...
What was the date on that again?
This Saturday.
This
March
Saturday
29.
Morning. The sight
okay,
of,
yep,
a,
right,
of, let's
yep.
say, a crescent-looking sun coming up or setting on the horizon could make the most dramatic sight, most dramatic
okay.
photograph. But the problem with this one, as Valerie pointed out, is it's only going to be about 20% eclipse. So we're
okay.
not going to get a crescent sun. We're only going to get a sun with
a little sliver.
Black blob
okay.
missing from
mm-hmm.
a from the left edge,
All
the,
right.
left, the left side.
Well, Jim, thanks a lot for the call. 800-348-2551. You really have animosity toward the partial eclipses.
I do.
I mean, they shouldn't make you mad. It's just
nature,
right?
Here's the thing. During the many since 1970 eclipse tours that I've led, after the total solar eclipse, when everybody's either crying from the emotion or blown out, you know who waits around to watch the one-hour-long partial eclipse that follows it? Nobody.
All right. Wow, you're such a solar elitist. It's ridiculous. Ryan in Albany. Ryan, you're on.
Hey, how are you?
Good.
So it's been a year almost since we saw the eclipse, an amazing event. And everybody owes it to themselves to see a solar eclipse before they die. So I've read since that every year the moon is moving away from the Earth by like something like the length of an earthworm every year. So that means at some point the moon will be far enough away that there's no eclipse. And at the same time, the rotation of the Earth is slowing down. So at some point, the sun is going to boil up the Earth's ocean. So what's going to happen first? Are we not going to be able to see a total eclipse, or will the oceans be boiled away?
Ah, great question.
What's your vote? What's your preference?
I'll take the moon moving far away.
Yeah, moon moving far away.
Yeah, that's a good plan.
Yeah, it's about an inch a year that the moon moves far, far away. And I've seen some disparate figures for how long it'll be before total eclipses stop because of that effect. And it seems to be about 80 million years is the earliest that I've seen for that. But the good news is that then afterward, the moon is going to start spiraling back again.
Oh, splendid.
So eclipses are going to be restored. Of course, the moon is going to continue coming in until it destroys Earth and destroys itself. Oh. And we have a set of rings like Saturn.
Tremendous. Ryan, thanks a lot. I appreciate the call. You know, that brings to mind another fear I have. Valerie and I were talking a bit about, I think a couple of months ago, maybe the not this last month, but the month before,
sure.
There was that newly discovered asteroid that for a brief time
yes.
was 3.5% chance of hitting, and then it went down the next day.
Yeah. Yeah.
So then I got thinking the other day, because this is, you know, if there's nothing to stress about, I got to stress about something. What if a big city killer sized asteroid hits the moon? What comes to, what happens to the Earth? Is stuff going to shower us?
Depends on the angle of impact,
whether
anything will ever reach us. But stuff does reach us because there's over a dozen lunar meteorites in hand that we have in hand that analysis shows came from the moon.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, I mean, if it hits directly and it bounces, you know, on the side of the moon that faces the Earth, some of it could bounce back. But if we hit it at an angle and it kind of just tosses it in the other direction, we'll be okay. Yeah.
You can own one. I have, as you know, I have a meteorite collection. I brought some in to show you guys.
Yes.
Yeah.
And if you're rich enough, which I think you are, Ray.
Oh, yeah.
You actually send away and have a meteorite that came from the moon.
Nice.
I'm sorry I spent most of my disposable income naming stars.
Yeah,
so
right.
Let's go to Todd in Saugerties. Todd, you're on.
I just wanted to clarify what you all were talking about before about earlier viewing of sun or of the sun with like a crack in a wall or a pinhole in the wall.
Yeah.
That's the predecessor to the camera. It's called a camera obscura.
You
want to have like a pinhole or a really crisp lens. If it's just a crack in the wall, it's not going to be very quality image.
Sure.
And you can do this very simply with the box you were describing, or if you have like a room with one window, you just darken that one window, no lights inside, and then just put a small pinhole in that, and it'll create the projection of the outside inside.
Yeah.
Camera obscura, predecessor to the camera.
I've done that, and it does work. It looked pretty funny lying on my belly in my driveway with a box on my head, but it did work.
Yeah.
This email from somebody who just says only me. PBS did a feature on Einstein's theories of time. One theory said that after a supernova, time will run backwards. Did I understand that is correctly? Because I never want to see my ex again. And that's from only me.
Stephen Hawking used to believe that if the universe ever stops expanding the way it is now and starts contracting, the arrow of time will start running backward.
Mm.
But he later changed his mind as if to demonstrate the process. So he no longer believes that, and
he doesn't believe much of anything, right?
Yeah, so I don't know what his current thoughts are.
Is he dead?
Stephen Hawking is no longer with us.
Current thoughts are not that strong.
I used to have some interaction with him because my agent, literary agent, is also his literary agent. So I have to throw that in. That's my one little claim to rubbing shoulders.
Did your agent ever say who was more difficult to get along with, you or Hawking?
I'm easy. I'm just easy.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we have a minute left, and we have no more calls. Valerie, say something.
Space can never be boring, though. You're like, we have a minute left and nothing to talk about. And I'm like, no, there's always so much fun things to talk about in space.
Everything's happening about relativity. When there's a minute left and there's nothing to talk about, it can seem like a very long time.
That's true, right? Right? Especially if you're moving really fast, you know, for those outside observers, it never ends.
I have something to say. This business about the Saturn equinox and the rings disappearing, be aware of this. In some places online, it says it's this week that just passed that the rings disappeared. However, everyone should be aware that the equinox on Mars, when the rings are actually sideways to the sun, is on May 6th. So that's yet to come. So, but on May 6th, and I did a simulation of this, we will see the rings not as a line, but we'll see them as rings. They won't disappear. Why is that?
I don't know.
Because as we go around the sun, the flat plane that we're in, like a vinyl record, is called the ecliptic plane. Well, Saturn is tipped 2.5 degrees from that. So we will only see Saturn edgewise when we're at a node or crossing point in that ecliptic plane. And when Saturn is actually in equinox on May, during the whole first week of May, it'll be visible. It'll be edgewise to the sun, but it won't be edgewise to us. Mm-hmm. So I'm just saying that the equinox on Saturn, in case you care about this, does not coincide with its rings disappearing through our telescopes. But that's all. Okay. You'll still see it.
Is time running backwards now? I don't
know. I mean, it just seems that way because I don't know when to shut
Bob,
up.
Bob, if people want to get in touch with you or find out where you're going this time, how do they do it?
Bob Berman Tours, and I hope they come with us to the Atacama Desert because we're going to visit Alma.
That sounds fun. Yeah,
I want you along sometime.
All right,
Valerie. If people want to find out about the lovely planetarium over at SUNY Oneonta, how do they do that?
Yes, tickets SUNY Oneonta Planetarium every Friday. Well, every other Friday and every Saturday we got shows.
Cool. Well, thank you both for being here. We'll see you next month. Support comes from Mountain Laurel Waldorf School, New Paltz, focused on clear thinking, balanced emotions, empathy for all, and love for meaningful work. Now enrolling parent-child through 8th grade. Open house April 5th, 10 a.m. to noon, mountainlaurel.org. Thanks again to Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson for being here. Thank you for listening. Thanks to Zach Malloy. Stayed awake the whole show. This kid's good. Thanks to Susie Chekai, who screened the calls. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, it's Food Friday. Beer and brewing. Okay, I'm coming in after all.